This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's great to be here today, and it's a pleasure to see so many friendly and familiar faces in the room. In this session, I'd like to focus on this whole idea of a pipeline of graduate talent. But before I do that, I do feel duty-bound to explain why in this era of getting our ducks in a row, tightening belts and, of course, perfect storms, why I would appear to be encouraging the use of yet another potentially equally painful metaphor. So by way of introduction, and also, I suppose, by way of explanation, the pipeline metaphor and an apology rather than an explanation. But the idea emerged from a lot of the work we do at CFE with employers, with graduate recruiters, but also particularly with SME recruiters. We do, for example, on behalf of the Association of Graduate Recruiters, their biannual survey, and you may have seen the research we did earlier this year, Generation Crunch, which explored the recruitment of graduates by SMEs. And what we found is that things like Brown, CSR, the funding cuts, they can all seem very distant from the day-to-day reality of actually going out and recruiting graduates. And I think employers are primarily interested in recruiting the brightest and the best that emerge from this talent pipeline. Richard Lambert put it very well in his fantastic speech to the CIHE last week, when he talked about many employers standing at the end of a conveyor belt, waiting for sort of graduates to emerge or to fall off the end of it into their employ. But the kind of the debate that I have certainly with many of these recruiters is that while this may seem very distant now, actually some of the policy changes that are being mooted could have a very significant impact on the quality and the quantity of the graduates that they will see coming through in the months and the years to come. So the key question is really, first of all, what this pipeline of graduate talent actually looks like. Secondly, to understand and identify where the blockages are. And thirdly, to assess perhaps how things might change in the post-Brown world. First of all, in terms of what the pipeline looks like, you would be forgiven for thinking that the pipeline looks something like this. Begins at A-levels at 17 or 18, university full-time, and a graduate training programme at 21 or 22, the so-called royal route, if you like, to a university education. Of course, and I think Aaron alluded to this earlier on, there is a far greater mix of students and graduates in the pipeline. I've just thrown out some examples here from HESA data from 2008-9, which is the I think the most recent data that's available, but it does give you a sense of the diversity. We have over 500,000 part-time UK undergraduate students, 353,000 UK students, and international students at both undergraduate and postgraduate level, something of the order of 368,000 students there as well. As I'm originally from the tropical paradise that is the Isle of Man, which is not part of the UK, I was actually categorised when I first went to university as an international student, and I discovered to my shame, I did go along to the receptions that I was invited to, primarily because there was drink there, but I did find to my shame that I didn't have the best English in the room, and I think if anything it's only got worse over time. But there were also, you know, a great deal of mature students in higher education as well, and we know that there are about 178,000 students in further education, and of course many of those are mature, studying part-time and in the workforce. So remind me, what is a graduate? The reason I've put this slide up, this came from the Generation Crunch piece that we did earlier in the year, and I think it's quite striking, really. It was a very simple question that we asked SME employers, which was, what is a graduate? You know, what qualification does an individual have to hold to be considered a graduate? And the results were fascinating, and you can see, and it's difficult, you'd need opera glasses to see this from the back, but something like a third of employers thought that an A-level was a graduate-level qualification, and 60% thought that a foundation degree, didn't realise that a foundation degree was a graduate-level qualification. So these are some of the issues that I think we're grappling with when we're talking about this whole issue of graduate employment and graduate employability. Definitions can be problematic. This old chestnut that graduate qualifications are always higher-level qualifications, but higher-level qualifications are not always graduate qualifications. So the example that Ofqual used to use on their website was that a Level 7 fellowship in music performance on the qualification and credit framework is actually at a higher level than a bachelor degree. And so, you know, I think this is more than semantics. It begs, I think, a much more important and interesting question, which is it the qualification that matters, or is it the experience of higher level learning, however that is experienced, or is it both? And I think that's a theme we'll return to later on, certainly in this presentation, hopefully later in the day. But it's perhaps no surprise when we did the most recent AGR survey that 78% of employers, which was a huge increase, 78% have reverted to a minimum 2-1 degree classification as their minimum entry criteria for their graduate recruitment programme. And perhaps unsurprising given the bamboozling array of credit frameworks and qualifications and that sort of thing. So definitions can be problematic, and they matter. And they matter because they narrow the focus of the debate. The debate, I think, becomes a little bit tired, a little bit predictable, a little bit samey. And it goes something like this. A-levels are getting easier. By my observation, this trend started the year after you did your A-levels. So in my case, A-levels were very difficult in 1995, but they got very, very difficult from 1996 onwards. Difficult, I know, with my boyish good looks to believe that I'm in my mid-30s, but there you go. Too many young people are going to university. This is a fascinating one, this, and we've heard a lot already this morning about the need for more information, for more advice and guidance and different options and informed consumers and all the rest of it. The problem with that is that we have long had a culture in this country of academic for the best and vocational for the rest. And so that leads into the very disingenuous debate about parity of esteem, while certainly amongst the chattering classes, all making sure that our own children are packed off to university at the earliest possible opportunity. And I think until that issue was addressed, which is as much as sort of a societal and cultural issue, we're not going to make an awful lot of progress on that. And of course, that we need to improve the employability skills of graduates. So where are the blockages in this pipeline? There's two types, by my observation. One is that some individuals simply don't enter or progress or indeed emerge from the pipeline. And the second is that some employers just don't get what they want from the pipeline, as we've heard already this morning. Now, in terms of individuals, you can disagree perhaps with the language that he chose to use, but Michael Gove, I think, has got it right here. I think he's got it spot on when he says that rich, thick kids do better than poor, clever children before they go to school. The point, I think, to take from that is that actually the pipeline of graduate talent doesn't begin at A-level. It doesn't even begin at school. It begins pretty much at birth, and in terms of the household and the income of the household in which you are born into. And this chimes with some of the research that we've done at CFE before. I think while the diagnosis is right, I do worry about some of the language that's been used by the coalition with regard to the cure. We have heard a lot, Michael Gove said before, that it's a scandal of a cohort of 80,000 children, only 45 make it to Oxbridge. Well, yes, it probably is. We could probably do with more than that. But I would worry if that was the only solution and if we were to go too far down a sort of a fairly narrow fair access to so-called selective or top universities rather than a more broad-based widening participation agenda. You may have seen the report from Hefke earlier this year, which was interesting. A fifth of the poorest go to higher education and three-fifths of the richest do. A fascinating study as well, looking at this issue at CFE. We've done a lot of work with AIM Higher and other such organisations. Lack of aspiration and or awareness can trump attainment. You only have to look at the applications to selective universities from young people with identical grades, but in different types of school. Twice as many applications to selective universities from young people in independent schools compared to those that go to the best comprehensives. And so, as I say, the issue there is one of aspiration rather than attainment, perhaps. And around 4% of advanced apprentices progress to higher education. At CFE at the moment, we're doing a study, 25 employer case studies, looking at 25 employers that have actually taken an advanced apprentice and supported them to progress to higher education. And I can tell you the most difficult thing about doing that research was finding 25 employers who had progressed an advanced apprentice to higher education, because it is something of a niche pursuit, certainly out of big businesses in this country. So they're the blockages from an individual's perspective. I think from the employer's perspective, employability skills, we've already heard a lot about this. There's been an enormous amount of research done on employability skills. No two lists of employability skills look the same, teamworking and all the rest of it as well. I agree what David has said, and he's been very vocal on this, and I agree with him on most things, but certainly on this one. This idea that we need to look beyond and go beyond the shopping list approach of having a graduate having a list of skills and somehow just trying to neatly and tidily merge them together. It is about learning to learn. It is about adaptive capacity and thinking in an entrepreneurial sort of way. Then borrowed from Richard Dawkins, what I call the STEM delusion. This issue that in the same way that the current government thinks apprentices are the answer to all of our country's ills, I think they also think the same about STEM. Just a few points on that. STEM, at its very broadest, consists of about 40%. Of all the subjects that are studied at higher education. So I think we need to be clear what it is that we mean by STEM. Hexu, I know Jane's here and we'll be talking later on. If you look at Hexu's latest graduate employment and unemployment figures as well, just to give you a flavour, students with a foundation degree had a 3% unemployment rate after graduating. Performing arts students had a 9% unemployment rate, and physics students had a 12% unemployment rate. So I think, you know, we just need to reflect a little bit on what we're doing with STEM. And what we're trying to achieve. We did work with David on The Fuse, which I would say this, but I think it's a fantastic piece, and it does highlight the importance of, in particular, the creative digital and the IT industries to this country's growth. And regulation can block. It's another blockage in the talent pipeline. One of the things, the work we do for AGR, we go to a lot of employer sector focus groups. So we meet with a lot of employers from different sectors. And I have to say that pretty much every single one that we go to, we get the same issue, which is this issue about regulation blocking the pipeline and visa requirements and migrant workers and point system and tiers and all the rest of it. And bless them, the UK Border Agency, you know, they rock up to these events and try and explain what the latest rules and regulations are. And I have to say, most of the employers, that when they leave, are none the wiser to when they came in. So I think that is a big issue. So breaking news, we've covered this already, so I won't labour the point. All employers are different, and they do strategy cuts across sector and geography. And I think it is important not to view the pipeline entirely through the lens of large graduate recruiters. While we do work with AGR, AGR will be the first to admit that they have a snapshot of the graduate recruitment market. It's by no means representative of every single employer that will at some point recruit a graduate. To illustrate that, This is a graphic taken from the Generation Crunch piece we did earlier in the year. A straightforward question, really: how many of the 500 SMEs that we surveyed had taken on a placement student or an intern in the previous 12 months? Only 9%, a tiny number. But you compare that with the number for AGR recruiters, typically larger employers, 74%. Had taken on certainly an intern student as well. Now, of course, there's a rich diversity within that. We have the graduate rich SMEs and all the rest of it. But I just make the point to sort of underline the fact that we can't treat employers as a homogenous mass. So how might the pipeline change in the post-Brown world? Well, I'll lead with the now infamous note from Liam Byrne, outgoing Chief Secretary of the Treasury, to his successor, and I suspect he rather regrets leaving this. It backfired somewhat. But what we have, I think it also acts as something of a motif for the months and the years to follow. We are inevitably in an era of more for less, to put it euphemistically. We have seen the burden of funding shifting from the taxpayer to the individual, and I think that would have happened anyway, but it certainly happened at an accelerated rate. Tuition fees of up to £9,000 per year, and graduates will pay more, inevitably, but there are competing assessments of the impact on participation. The government would say that actually the poorest 30% will be better off and will pay less. I don't really want to get into that particular debate. I don't want people with balaclavas climbing outside the walls of CFE. But inevitably, we'll have to see how this pans out. One point I would make, though, is that the £150 million national scholarships programme that was included in the government's response, I mean, that's roughly equivalent to the Aim Higher budget for 2 years. So a bit of clarity on what we mean by this. I mean, is this programme to replace or to supplement the work that Aim Higher has been doing? Obviously, the future of Aim Higher hangs in the balance. And 150 million quid doesn't buy you an awful lot, certainly not in the great scheme of things. I mean, fully funded, it would cover 5,500 places at £9,000 a year. So I think that is an issue that we need to look again at. And Aaron, I mean, I've nicked this line from Aaron. You talked about a consumer revolution and the emergence potentially of a seller-buyer relationship that will drive up standards. In theory, a lot of the graduate recruiters that we work with and talk to would be very pleased with this. They would see this as a good thing. But it is a strange sort of market. And, you know, in my view, politicians, they like the idea of a market more than the reality. And it is a strange sort of market. This was a line taken from a student on the radio only last week who said, "I'm going to pay 9K for what was 3K to receive the same service." Now, you could argue with that and the caveats around it and the nuances and the subtleties and all of the rest of it. But if it is a market, then the perceptions of consumers matter. And at the moment, this is the perception that is held by a good number of students. And so that is something that in a true market will have to be addressed. And of course, this has all come at a time when graduate unemployment, according to the latest HECSU report, is at a 17-year high, and graduate salaries from both HECSU and AGR remain static. But sometimes I think, we have to put this issue of graduate unemployment into a bit of perspective. I've always found it a little bit distasteful to summon up the language of the First World War when we're talking about graduate unemployment, talk of a lost generation of young graduates. I think the truly dispossessed are those that leave school without any qualifications at all. We saw the IPPR and Private Equity Foundation report that came out earlier in the month. 36% of young people with no qualifications will be not in education, employment, and training. And compare that to 11 or 12%, which was the latest stats on those with a degree at any age. But of course, there's no national union of NEETs. There's no equivalent to the NUS with very articulate leaders like Aaron to fight their cause. And I think that although graduates can, of course, find themselves to be out of education, employment, or training for a period of time, they're much more likely to find their way back into the labour market, and often at the expense of their less qualified counterparts. So final point, really, whose priority? I mean, this is something that I think we have covered and makes us all a little bit nervous. We've heard about public funding being withdrawn from non-priority subjects, government playing a greater role in what is funded. But I suppose the question is, can you centrally plan a market-based system? And if the experience of the further education sector over recent years is anything to go by, then the answer is a resounding no. Government has a historically very bad reputation for picking winners in most arenas, and I wouldn't expect education to be any different to that. And so I think the key is to if we are going to make an investment, and if government is to make an investment, it would be better to make the investment in the adaptive capacity of institutions, of further education colleges and of universities to engage with their consumers in their market, which could be individuals, could be employers, and of course often a combination of the two, and allow those to make the decisions. And I think it's that kind of engagement between institutions and employers that will get us out of the mess that we currently find ourselves in. So that's it from me. Thank you.